Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Andrea Fisher Merrill about Big Brothers Big Sisters of Northern New Mexico. Right now, I'd like to welcome Melissa Crane Draper. She's the co-editor, along with Jim Schultz, of the book Dignity and Defiance, Stories from Bolivia's Challenge to Globalization. And the two of them will be speaking at St. John's College on Tuesday of next week, February 10th at 6 in the evening in the Junior Common Room at St. John's. Welcome, Melissa, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
Let's talk for a moment about globalization. It's not the fact of globalization, which isn't going anywhere, that the Bolivians in your book are defying. It's a particular unfair kind of globalization. Talk more about that.
That's right. Well, Bolivia is a small developing country in South America, has a particularly intense experience with globalization, and it comes on all fronts, really, economically, politically, also socially and culturally. And it deals with the environment. So our book is looking at all those different faces of globalization. And it's true, the Bolivians aren't outwardly rejecting or blindly rejecting globalization. They're really trying to make it something that works for them, that can benefit them. So there's been some really sad experiences in the past two decades that have to deal with multinational corporations going into Bolivia and really exploiting the lack of the government's protection of the Bolivian people's public interests. But there's also some good experiences it's had with globalization. So our book explores some of those nuances and tries to give concrete human stories that can tell us what globalization really means for people on the ground.
Tell us, if you don't mind, the basic story of the water revolt in Cochabamba. This is a story that I think probably a lot of people have kind of heard about, but it's an incredible story of resistance.
Yes, it is. And Bolivia, through that story, really became a poster child for the anti-globalization movement across the globe. And Jim Schultz, my co-editor, was really part of the story from the very beginning. It's a phenomenal example of globalization and the inspiring story of how the Bolivian people decided, you know what, in this form, we're not so happy with globalization, and we're going to take a stand against it. Jim Schultz was actually there in Cochabamba in 2000, April of 2000, when the water revolt began in the central city of Cochabamba. And it's a story of a multinational coming in at the bidding of the World Bank in this era of privatization, when it was seen that privatization was the answer to most of the developing world's trials and tribulations. And so the World Bank recommended, hey, let's privatize Cochabamba's water system. That'll allow a huge injection of private capital, and it'll improve the system for everyone in Cochabamba. But they didn't really do their homework. They signed the contract behind closed doors, and they upped the prices incredibly for people making only $100 a month. They were asked to pay $20 for their water bill. And so you're dealing with a real misunderstanding of how you can bring privatization into a community, a culture that sees water as a common good. It's not a commodity. In this instance, the big multinational corporation was Bechtel, based in San Francisco, where I'm speaking from today. And it was a real wake-up call to the fact that that the people themselves could really stand up to this. When the water bills shot up, the people took to the streets. And we're talking people from every class. This wasn't just the most impoverished classes, but every class across the board. And they forced the government to break that contract. And it made the World Bank rethink some of its pressures to make countries like Bolivia privatize some of their public systems. So Jim's going to talk about that at our events, both on Monday at the El Museo Cultural and also Tuesday at St. John's. And he has some real amazing personal accounts of what he saw in the streets in Cochabamba.
And some of those are in the book. It's an incredible story. The whole book is worth just the chapter on the Cochabamba Water Revolt. The book, by the way, is called Dignity and Defiance, Stories from Bolivia's Challenge to Globalization. There are many fascinating parts of that story, and one of them is that what Bechtel, with the help of the Bolivian government, did was actually legally take over something in which they'd had no hand in creating in the first place, namely the irrigation canals and pipes that were totally created by the Bolivian people by hand. Ditches dug and pipes fitted together, and suddenly they belong to Bechtel.
Exactly, and that's where you see a real clash of cultures. You have a company coming in and saying that they need to make profit off of charging for these water systems. And yet, in the peri-urban areas of the city of Cochabamba, only about 500,000 people, you had community-based water committees working to get water into people's homes. So you can imagine the shock of a family having worked with these community water systems, getting a bill from a foreign company, namely a company that was related and connected back to the United States, saying that they need to pay up to $20, maybe one-fifth of the family income for the month. It was just an outrage for the locals there.
The Bechtel's business plan was to make a profit of $50 million, which really came from the pockets of these very poor people. And after the whole thing was over and there was, you know, fighting in the streets and people died and an international solidarity on the part of the Bolivian people and all of this, then Bechtel tried to bring legal action to recover the $50 million in the profits that they wanted to get. And that, again, was met with international outrage and demonstrations.
That's right. And that's where the Democracy Center, the group that helped produce this book as a team effort, was able to help mobilize an incredible showing of international solidarity. 40 organizations from 40 different countries around the world signed on to petitions and helped to pressure Bechtel, and that even included street protests here in San Francisco at the headquarters in front of Bechtel. And ultimately, Bechtel tried to take that demand to the World Bank, to its international investor tribunal, which we refer to as ICSID, and they tried to reclaim that money from the Bolivian government. $50 million means a lot to a country like Bolivia. It may not mean a lot to a corporation like Bechtel, maybe just a profit that they make in less than a week's time. But for Bolivia, that's real money. So it was a phenomenal showing of international solidarity and activism around the globe that resulted in a personal intervention, we were later told, by the CEO of Bechtel, Riley Bechtel, intervened and said, make this headache go away. Bechtel took their case back and symbolically settled the case with the Bolivian government for a mere 20 cents, I believe it was.
Right. So we're talking to Melissa Draper about Dignity and Defiance. And they will be talking, Melissa Draper and Jim Schultz will be speaking on Tuesday of next week at St. John's College. The story of the Bolivian people being able to truly rise up, cancel a contract, take their water company in Cochabamba back, you know, that's a story that we hear about. What we don't hear about so much is what happened to the water company afterwards. Did the rates go down? Are the people happily supplied with water? Is it working better than it would have otherwise?
Well, that's the key question, and that's something that in going back over now 8 years after the water revolt, we have to be very honest in saying, look, canceling and saying that privatization is an absolute evil is not something that stands true. The water revolt was an incredible story, but if we look at the aftermath, then now in 2008, 2009, the state water company that's now in charge of the water system in Cochabamba is not running absolutely smoothly. There's still major problems with the system, with hookups to these peri-urban areas that need water the most. So by no means has it been a perfect story. By no means is this anti-globalization call a clear-cut, joyous victory. It's something that the Bolivian people are still struggling with. And even today we're seeing with the new administration under President Morales, some of its officials are saying, look, we've got to look at more creative, innovative ways maybe to not go whole hog with the privatization, but see how the people can still have control, and yet we can still get investors and injection of capital into some of these systems to make these public services accessible to everybody.
And we'll talk about that more in a few minutes. I think that the Bechtel story has in it an element which really should be an oxymoron to hardcore capitalists, namely guaranteed profit. That was part of the Bechtel thing, profit without investment. And that kind of desire for profit without investment wasn't just Bechtel. It was a number of other companies. There's an oil and gas story in the book featuring the beloved Enron and Shell. How do they get away with these deals that put so much profit in the hands of the companies, so little in the hands of the people, when the Bolivians are the ones, the Bolivian government, the Bolivian people, are the ones that have the resource that they want?
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. I think there's two answers to it. One is that you have institutions like the World Bank, like the International Monetary Fund, driven primarily by U.S. interests, that are very powerful. They were very powerful and wielded a lot of influence over Bolivian administrations, especially prior to President Morales. So we're talking through the 80s and 90s with presidents like Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, who themselves really ascribed to this capitalist privatization model. They themselves were trained in the Chicago School here in the United States, and they carried that with them to Bolivia and into the presidential palace in Bolivia. It's only with this most recent administration, with President Morales, the first indigenous president of Bolivia, where you're seeing the administration, the government of Bolivia, really questioning those international structures of power. And so you have the IMF, the World Bank, and the instance of the water revolt. The World Bank was pressuring for what they thought, in theory, was right. They thought privatization was the way to answer the problems with Bolivia's water system. And it's true. I don't think Jim or I ascribe to the view that people at the World Bank and the IMF get up in the morning and ask themselves, how can we make life more difficult for impoverished Bolivians? That's not what they're doing. What we're seeing is a huge gap between theory and reality and how these economic theories really work out in a place like Bolivia, where you have social, cultural, political factors that you might just not know about if you're in your office in Washington, D.C. on Pennsylvania Avenue. And so you have the combination of these international institutions driven by theory, coupled with these previous Bolivian administrations who really believed that they could do better with it, but at the same time were under great pressure. IMF and the World Bank would dangle aid in front of Bolivia and say, you know, if you don't follow these privatization suggestions that we offer, we can't approve you, and therefore they can effectively block bilateral aid from other countries. They can block aid from the World Bank. And for a country like Bolivia, foreign aid is their lifeline. They need that help from international partners.
It's still hard to understand, after so many broken promises and disasters, like there's a chapter on this huge oil spill in the Desaguadero River, and then the draining of Bolivia's resources. And this isn't just the last few decades. This has been going on for way early into the 20th century and before, if you go back to the conquest and so on. You would think that there would be more consciousness about this on the part even of Bolivian politicians who were educated in the United States and so on. I mean, are the conservative, corporate-friendly Bolivian legislators getting something out of this? Out of siding with U.S. corporations, for example?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we can see in the example of this, the former president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, educated in Texas and under the Chicago School of Economic Theory. He himself was a very successful capitalist. He owned mines in Bolivia and definitely benefited, in the instance of some of the gas lines, benefited directly. So you definitely see examples of extreme corruption, and that's something where the existing administrations, politicians, congressmen did benefit directly from some of these investments or having these foreign investors in the country. So absolutely, the Bolivian government rarely has had the interests of the Bolivian public in mind, and that also has to do with issues of history and culture and the racial and ethnic differences that you see in Bolivia. Bolivia is an intensely diverse country. absolutely fascinating, but you have a majority indigenous population that by no means is homogenous in and of itself. You have Quechua, Aymara, Guarani, which are the three largest of 36 different indigenous populations. And then you have a very small European-descended elite that has traditionally been in power. And prior to President Evo Morales, they had been, quote, democratically elected, indeed elected by the not the majority of Bolivians, but 20%, 30% of the voting public. Evo Morales is the first ever president in the history of Bolivian democracy to be voted in with more than 50% of the popular vote. And that's due to the parliamentary process of election and the coalition building that they did in Congress. So, yes, it's an amazing phenomenon to understand, but there you have, for so many decades, had elites in power in the presidential palace not interested in representing the interests of the majority of Bolivians.
We're talking to Melissa Draper. She and Jim Schultz will be speaking on Tuesday, February 10th at St. John's College at 6 in the evening. So tell us more about Evo Morales. On what platform was he elected in 2005, and what has he actually been able to do? What kind of resistance and challenges is he facing?
Yes, well, Evo Morales was elected at the end of 2005 after Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada had left and fled to the United States, and his vice president, who then became president for a short period of time in 2005, also had to step down as president. So it was a very conflictive time in Bolivia, and the people were making a few key demands. Two of those were, one, remaking the Constitution, redrafting entirely from ground zero a constitution that represents a diverse and largely indigenous country. Previous constitutions were based on the European model and, again, written by those European-descended elites who had very little interest in expressing and the interests of the Bolivian majority. And so the Constitution has been an important demand for a long time, especially from indigenous populations. And Evo Morales was very clear in his platform that he was going to make that happen when he was president. And he has followed through on that. We've just seen January 25th of this year, the Bolivian public voted in a referendum to pass the Constitution that's been drafted over the past 2 years. It's been a very difficult process and has lost its way in many regards, but it was a call by the majority of Bolivians, and Evo Morales has followed up on that process, on that promise. And the other major issue was the nationalization of natural resources, particularly the gas and oil sector. That is also a bit more of a complicated topic, but Evo Morales has followed through on that promise to some extent. He calls it nationalization. This happened back in May of 2006. He nationalized, in quotes, the gas and oil sector. If you look at the fine print, it's actually not a complete nationalization. They didn't take over the entire sector. They allowed many of the private companies to stay in Bolivia and, in essence, renegotiated the contracts to give better benefits to the state. But they by no means kicked everybody out wholesale. They did not confiscate property without compensation. So that's a very important clarification to make, because the international media has repeatedly made the mistake of calling it nationalization because President Morales calls it nationalization to appeal to his more radical bases in Bolivia.
Interesting. It's interesting that, I mean, the resistance that happened in the late, in the 90s and in this century, in this new millennium, it's a story that has real roots, it has deep roots in Bolivia. What are some of the other stories of exploitation and resistance that Bolivians have seen historically, and what methods did they use to deal with them?
Yeah, well, we have another example in our book. We have an entire chapter on the coca issue, which is one of great importance to Bolivia, and it's an example of kind of a historical struggle that's come into the current current day of modern politics, and particularly related to the United States. And that's a story of a sacred plant that was used during colonial times to exploit Bolivians and allowing them to work 16, 20 hours a day toiling in the mines of Potosí and Oruro to extract silver and other precious metals that then went on to support the success of the Spanish Empire. There's a story that young Bolivians are told when they're in elementary school that the amount of silver extracted from just one special hill called Cerro Rico in Potosí actually could have been used to build an entire bridge from South America to Spain across the Atlantic. That was how much silver they took out of Bolivia, leaving that hill entirely empty in the city of Potosí. And so you have an example of how the colonial powers use this coca plant, which is a mild stimulant, to allow for these indentured servants, the Bolivians, primarily indigenous, to mine the silver and other metals. And now, although that plant remains sacred to the culture of most Bolivians, it's used in ceremonies and rituals, it's used for medicinal purposes, and we drink it as tea. Anybody who lives in Bolivia drinks it as tea as a regular habit. But the U.S., through its policy with the war on drugs, has really demonized that plant and unfortunately confuses it to be the exact same and just as evil as the drug cocaine. Indeed, coca is an ingredient to make cocaine, but it's kind of like grapes and wine. You can't confuse a grape with wine. It has to go through a long process of fermentation and use of other ingredients before it can become something like cocaine. So that's something that Bolivians are facing today and has become central also to President Morales' platform. I myself was there in 2001 when the coca-growing region was militarized by about 12,000 soldiers, Bolivian soldiers, but paid entirely with U.S. taxpayers' dollars under the policies of the war on drugs. And there are rapes and there are deaths in Bolivia that are related specifically to those policies that come out of Washington. As a result, President Morales, who was originally a coca grower union leader, he found his support there. And the reason he was launched onto the national stage and gained so much political leverage to become president was because that issue is so central to Bolivians' outlook on foreign policy and how the U.S. is operating in the world, in their world.
I was thinking about the resistance movements that you describe in this book in Bolivia, and then the different kinds of protests that we've had in this country, and looking at the elements that made resistance of various kinds possible in Bolivia, for example, in Cochabamba, but in other places as well. Strong unions, that's one thing. Neighborhood uh-huh. associations. A lot of local radio call-in shows. People's willingness to walk miles and miles and miles. I mean, they're very strong people. They're willing to fight and endure tear gas and worse than tear gas. And they have a kind of collective identity. And these are all things that really make them, even the poorest people in this country, really strong and able to do huge, amazing things. And I sometimes wonder, could we do that ourselves here?
Yeah, you make a good point. I mean, Bolivians has continued to be an inspiration. I think that's why so many of us foreigners are attracted to that country. The intensity with which Bolivians view their role in political decisions and their sense of what we call civil society, their participation as citizens in a democracy is just one of the most inspirational things I've seen. And you're right, they exercise these different mechanisms of protest. Radio is central, absolutely central to communication, especially in the rural areas, and to garnering support and organizing and mobilizing people. It's just impressive how with not only in the water revolt where you had 100,000 people marching on the central plaza in downtown Cochabamba, you also in the gas war in 2003, October of 2003, had even more than that, more than 100,000 people marching on the city of La Paz. And so the ability to mobilize, but I think also just the attitude of each individual Bolivian, that they really do have the power to influence change when they are organized and mobilized together, is just, it's an amazing thing. There is no sense of helplessness or indifference. I'm not sure those exist in Bolivia. So it's a very refreshing thing, and I think it's something that American citizens can learn so much from, the importance of being able to vote, the importance of being able to have a voice in your own democracy.
And the other part of it is the importance of media, including international media, because the way Bechtel was defeated was not in the World Bank Tribunal. It was, they basically backed down because of international pressure, which was brought to bear by the fact that so many people outside of Bolivia knew what Bechtel had done in Bolivia and shamed them into saying, okay, we give up.
Exactly. And there's an example where within Bolivia, there wasn't at first knowledge of who this company was. Bechtel went into Bolivia under the name Aguas del Tunari, which is a Spanish name that you would think could be any kind of private company. And it wasn't until a foreigner, and it was actually Jim Schultz, who really dug into that and realized that Aguas del Tunari was a subsidiary of Bechtel. So in this instance, it was the combination of savviness, but also passion for the issue, and a combined team of, in this instance, foreigners and Bolivian social movement leaders that was able to bring this out into the light. And then you have these networks, and the Bolivians are an incredible example of being able to network at an international level, where you have water activists in Bolivia who have, you know who their counterparts are in the Philippines, in the United States, in Mexico, in parts of Europe. And so that powerful network can be called on in these moments of really extreme and intense battles with foreign companies. And also you can see where there have been other examples. Maybe Bechtel, maybe other multinational corporations have done similar things in other countries. But unless there's that international network to pick up on that and highlight those connections, then those local struggles stay isolated. So absolutely, the role of international solidarity has been key to Bolivians making their voices heard beyond Bolivia.
Melissa Crane Draper and Jim Schultz are co-editors and contributors to the book Dignity and Defiance, Stories from Bolivia's Challenge to Globalization, and they will be speaking at St. John's College in the Junior Common Room on Tuesday, February 10th at 6 in the evening. I want to thank you so much for spending all this time with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, Melissa.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. I really appreciate it.
We're going to take a little break right now, and we'll be back. Please stay tuned to KSFR.